Today's guest is Kim Lisa Taylor. She's the founder of Syndication Attorneys, a Florida-based law firm that provides securities offering documents for clients nationwide. She's also the author of Amazon's number one best-selling book, How to Legally Raise Private Money, and has completed hundreds of securities offerings. Things that I wanted to ask you was, in terms of your background and how you got started in this very niche area of law practice.
Well, back in 2006, my husband and I went to Learning Annex presentation. If anybody remembers Learning Annex, that's part of the audience. That was a long time ago. But they had something up in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles Convention Center, and they had all these different real estate entrepreneurial programs available, and you just kind of walked around and, you know, picked your room. And we saw this one that was for multifamily apartments, and thought, oh, that would be interesting. And I had actually had a little bit of introduction to that topic even in a former position. I used to be an environmental consultant, and I had a position where we were doing housing inspections for the Department of Housing and Urban Development at big multifamily projects around the country. And the firm I worked for was an architectural and an environmental firm. So we were doing architectural review of everything that was wrong with the property. We would create entire lists of everything that was wrong. We would put dollars to that, and then create these long notebooks that would HUD would use to tell the owners, like, you've got to make all these repairs or we're going to foreclose on the property and take it over. So I was interested in multifamily, just having been introduced to it that way. So we went to this Learning Annex, and we decided, my husband and I, to go in and hear what this guy, David Lindahl, had to say. And it was interesting. So we bought the home study course, and we thought, well, you know, my husband was a real estate investor. He'd been doing it for a long time already. And I had, you know, enough experience. I thought, oh, we can just do this on our own. Well, of course, we did nothing, right? Isn't that what everybody does when you buy a home study course? You pay for it and you take it home, and it sits in a box or on your shelf. And then eventually you give it away. So I started listening to some of the calls that were coming out from this group. And I heard one where they said they were going to have a boot camp. And I thought, well, we should go to that. So I conned my husband. This was like a year and a half later. I said, well, if we're going to do something with this, let's just go to this. So we went to the boot camp, and we learned, you know, so much our heads were spinning. And then they announced at the boot camp that they were going to have a private money boot camp. And I thought, well, we should do that too. And at that time, I was a pretty new attorney. I'd been practicing for about 3 years, but I was really kind of looking for the area of practice I wanted to focus on. And so we went to the private money boot camp. And while we were there, there was an attorney on stage that was talking about securities and securities offerings and all those things. And so I listened to him. His name was Gene Trowbridge. And I approached him after the event and said, I'm interested in learning this area of the law. I'd be happy to work with you. He said, well, yeah, maybe we should. And it turned out that we were in Boston at this event, but he and I lived about 75 miles apart in Southern California at the time. So we got together, and I started working with him, worked with him for a couple of years. Then he and I decided to start a firm together, doing securities offerings. We did that in January of 2010, and I worked with him up until 2016 in March, and then my husband and I decided we were going to move to Florida. So we took off for Florida, and then I set up my own practice in Florida.
So. Got it. And talking about private money, I mean, your book is very fascinating in terms of it talks about real estate syndications and different players in that real estate syndication. I was wondering, for our listeners that are not as familiar with syndication, could you walk us through what is a real estate syndication, and perhaps even walk us through the different players in that syndication?
Sure. Well, a syndication, the definition of a syndicate is just a group formed for a common purpose. So it could be two people, it could be 20 people, and that are pooling resources for a common goal. And so the resources that are being pulled are, you know, from the syndication side, the people that are organizing the group, they're putting together all their time and their efforts and their education and their background to bring the deals to the investors. And then the investors are putting up the money to pay for the down payment, the closing costs, acquisition fees for the management group, any capital improvements that are going to be made afterwards, and some capital or some reserves. So, you know, that's pretty much how the syndication, you know, the broad overview of it. You know, certainly there's a lot of intricacies within it. There's really two main parts. One is the securities compliance aspect of it, and that's how do you comply with securities laws? What are the rules that apply? And then the second part of that is how do you structure that deal with investors, and what kind of contract and contractual arrangement are you going to have with your investors?
And so would you say in syndication, the person that is, or the group of people that might be putting it together is sort of like a general partner. The investors, you could say, is the limited partner. And then the syndication is a private offering. Would you say those are the terminologies that are used?
Those are some of the terminology that's used. The distinction is that the terms you've used, the general partner and the limited partner, describe the players in a limited partnership, which is one way to do syndications. But another way to do them is with an LLC. And it's really the identical structure, but different terminology. So when you're using an LLC, instead of having a general partner, you're going to have a manager. And instead of limited partners, you're going to have members.
Got it. And so in terms of the LLC structure, would you set up the higher level LLC in like either Delaware or Wyoming, and then have the other LLCs in the state where the property is located? Is that generally the structure?
When it's feasible and when it makes sense, we'll form the investor level entity in Delaware. So what we're talking about, just to back up one step, is that within this structure, there's going to be multiple LLCs. So you'll have one LLC that is going to sell the interests to investors. And so that's a company that's formed that's going to buy the real estate and going to sell off part of its ownership interest to investors. And then a portion of the ownership interests are going to be retained by the manager. Then that investor level entity is manager managed. So the manager itself is also going to be an LLC. And that management entity is going to be comprised of the individuals who are putting the deal together. And that could be structured as a joint venture where it's member managed and all the members are considered to be in management, or it could be structured as a manager managed entity where one or two people are kind of in control. They're the ones signing on the loan. There's some other people that are providing services that are just within that membership structure. And big deals. So when you get to a point where you're going to have over a $10 million loan balance, there's actually going to be another layer of LLCs in there. And that's going to be, instead of having the investor level LLC also be the title holding entity, we would create a separate title holding entity called a single purpose entity, takes title to the property, becomes the borrower on the bank loan, and is usually owned 100% by that investor level LLC.
Got it. And so, but the question is, if an investor has enough money to invest in a syndicate, maybe you can walk through some of the fees, but why not just do it themselves? Why go into syndication and pay these fees? Why not just do it themselves?
Well, it's first of all, they're probably, most syndicates are formed to buy something that's big enough that a single investor isn't going to take it down very easily. Usually they're going to be putting together groups of investors who are investing $50,000 to $100,000 at a time to come up with $1 million or $2 million or even $5 or $10 million to create one of these syndicates. So the management is really providing a service for these passive investors where they're providing them a vehicle to invest in commercial real estate without having to be the people in charge of it or having to come up with all the money on their own.
Got it. So someone who has $1 million may not be able to get into something that is, you probably need $10 million to buy, but as a group, you'll be able to get into that deal.
That's right.
Okay. In terms of you keep hearing this terminology these days about crowdfunding. How is syndicate same or different than crowdfunding?
So crowdfunding is really just a means of advertising a legal securities offering. So the process that we described when we were talking about what's a syndicate, right? So a syndicate is kind of the structure and how it all works together. The securities offering component of that is how you're going to raise the money within the constraints of appropriate securities laws.
Got it. And so in terms of appropriate security laws, so let's say somebody is very good at, he's been successful with a commercial real estate and they want to be able to raise capital through syndication, and eventually find accredited investors. So can you walk us through that process of talking to accredited investors? Because I know, I think there was a couple of chapters in your book that actually dealt with that. And I actually thought that was really fascinating. So maybe you can talk about how to talk to accredited investors without getting in trouble with the securities laws.
Well, so it's first of all, you're not only limited to having accredited investors in your deals if you're doing a syndication. So the securities component of a syndicate is where we're going to decide what kind of suitability qualifications that these investors have before they can invest in the deal. So when you're just kind of go back and do a really quick primer securities 101. Securities include things that are called investment contracts and even certain promissory notes in the context of real estate. So, an investment contract is an investment of money in a common enterprise with an expectation of profits based solely on the efforts of the promoter. So, that's the technical definition. In practical terms, it's when you're taking control of somebody else's money and they're relying on you to generate a profit, you're selling them a security and you're giving them ownership interests in your company. So that investment contract is a security. Now we know that's a security. So what does that mean? Well, that means that in order to sell that to somebody and to exchange that contract for money, you actually have to either register your offering or qualify for an exemption from registration. So the registration process is what these companies go through to go public. Facebook did it, Google did it. You know, they fill out piles of paperwork, submit them to the securities regulators, and go back and forth a bunch of times. Finally, the SEC says, okay, it's all right, you can sell this, you can sell it to the public, you can use public stock exchanges, things like that. That's what it takes to go public. That's a long, drawn out process that doesn't work for real estate because in real estate, you usually have a property under contract and you've got about 90 days to close on that property. So for real estate, we use an exemption from registration. And there's multiple exemptions that you can use, but each one has its own set of rules. So the exemptions that are available are Regulation D, Rule 506, is the most commonly used exemption. And there's two options under Rule 506. There's Rule 506B and Rule 506C. So 506B is the original rule. And Rule 506C is the rule that came out of the Jobs Act. So Rule 506B is the one that allows you to raise an unlimited amount of money from an unlimited number of accredited investors and up to 35 non-accredited investors, but you can't find your investors through any means of general advertising or solicitation, and the investors are allowed to self-certify that they meet the requirements to participate. So they either have to show that they're accredited or they have to fill out a form saying that, yes, I meet the definition of a sophisticated investor, which is somebody who's got more than just some savings and a job. They have some level of sophistication either through their business or their education prior investing experience or some training that would allow them to understand what they're getting into. The Rule 506C exemption is just a variation of that, but it allows you to raise an unlimited amount of money from an unlimited number of verified accredited investors. But general solicitation and advertising is allowed. So as long as you're doing a 506C offering, you can freely advertise to anybody you want. So that's kind of, so the accredited is, in case somebody doesn't know the definition of accredited, that's somebody who has $1 million worth of net worth, $1 million net worth, excluding any equity in their primary residence, or they have $200,000 a year income if they're single, or $300,000 a year income if they're married. So just kind of give you that background on that. So, you know, back to your original question, how do you find accredited investors? Well, you don't necessarily just have to find accredited investors. You just have to find accredited or sophisticated investors. And then how would you go about talking to them? You really just want to develop some rapport, just like you would talk to anybody else you would meet in any other business setting. You want to figure out what they do, talk to them about what you do. At some point, you will need to have a more detailed conversation with them, talking about their suitability to be in your deals. So you're usually not going to do that when you first meet them. You're usually going to schedule some kind of a follow-up, and then you're going to go through a questionnaire with them to find out, are they accredited? Are they not accredited? If they're not accredited, how are they sophisticated? What things have they invested in before? You know, would they be comfortable investing in a deal that you're going to hold on to for 5 to 7 years? What kind of returns are they looking for? You really just want to flesh all that out.
So I want to dive a little bit deeper into that. So let's say, for example, somebody is going to use that 506B where there's no advertising allowed. And in page 98, 99 of your book, it talks about how to go into that conversation with that investor to determine in the investor suitability. So let's pretend somebody comes from a family without family money, without a rich uncle, but they're really good at what they do. They bootstrap themselves. They've been doing this for a while, and they want to talk to these investors to determine suitability. So can you walk us through how that conversation would happen with somebody without breaking the 506B rules of no advertising?
Well, I think the first thing you got to do is you got to preface it with saying, look, we don't want to make this conversation all about me. Let's talk about you and what you're looking for. And then explain to them that the securities regulations, when you're offering people investment opportunities, you have to comply with securities laws. And the securities laws require that you get to know them and a little bit about their background and suitability for your deals, but also because you want to make sure that what you have to offer meets with their investment goals. And so if they don't mind, then you'd like to ask them a few questions. And then you can start asking them, and just say, I'm not trying to be invasive here. I just, need to know this, so I make sure I'm offering you the right deals and we're not wasting time. So, you'll ask them, one of the suitability requirements is in certain deals, you might have to be accredited. Can I ask you if you meet one of these definitions? And then you could give them the definition that I just gave you, the 1 million net worth or the income requirements, and say, do you meet any of those definitions? And let them say yes or no. If they say no, say, well, that doesn't mean that you can't invest. It just means that there are certain deals you might not be able to invest in. But let's ask a little bit more, if you're non-accredited, about what kind of other investing experience you have and other people that, other things you might have done in the past. Have you ever owned your own investment real estate? Did you go to college? What is your degree in? Have you invested heavily in the stock market? Have you ever attended any educational events? Would you be interested in attending some educational events? Things like that. So you're really just trying to get to know them, and then also talk to them about when might they have a use for the funds. Like if they were to invest with you, would they be comfortable leaving their investment dollars with you in a project for 5 to 7 years? When do they need the money? What's their retirement plan? Do they have a need to put somebody through college? or something like that.
Got it. So let's say you're meeting with them first. You just get to know the investor, but do you have to wait for subsequent meetings? Is there a passage of time requirement, or is it the quality of that relationship?
It's more about the quality of the relationship. This was actually just defined in 2016. The SEC wrote a letter called a no action letter. So when somebody wants to do something and they want to make sure that the SEC isn't going to find it to be a violation of securities laws, they request a no action letter. And so they'll craft the letter and say, look, we want to do this, 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 and this. They'll explain exactly what the policies and the procedures are going to be. And then they'll submit it to the SEC and said, if we did everything just this way, would you consider that to be a violation of securities laws? And the SEC will review it and then they'll respond and say, well, as long as you did this, this, and this, and this, and did it exactly this way, then we would not consider that to be a violation of securities laws. That's called a no action letter. So there was a company called Citizen VC that submitted a no action request to the SEC, and they got back a letter that kind of defined what the SEC requires to determine the pre-existing substantive relationship. So let's just back up one step, though. So we were talking about this Regulation D Rule 506B that has these requirements. You can include up to 35 non-accredited investors, but you can't find them through any means of general advertising or solicitation. So the way to prove that you didn't find them through general advertising or solicitation, which is advertising to the public, standing up in front of a group, making an announcement at a meetup, whether it's live or whether it's in a meetup group on LinkedIn or Facebook or something like that. Any kind of announcement to the general public. So this is where you have to show that you had a pre-existing substantive relationship with that person before you made them an offer to invest with you. So that's what the pre-existing substantive relationship is about. It's your proof that you knew that person well enough and had that relationship so they didn't find out about your deal through advertising. And so we're trying to establish through this questions that we've been talking about for the last few minutes, what it takes to have that pre-existing substantive relationship. So the questions that I just went through are the suitability questions that you would ask somebody to determine whether, to get to know them well enough to know whether they were appropriate and suitable for your deal. So in the VC Citizen no action letter, that was what the SEC focused on. It said it's more important that you understand the suitability of the investor than it is to have a period or passage of time between when you first met them and when you made them an offer. So let me just talk about an experience. If you have somebody who's next door to you that maybe you've known for 20 years, but you've never had a conversation with them about their finances, in the SEC's world, they wouldn't be somebody that you could ask to invest with you until you'd had that conversation, because just because they live next door, you have no idea what they make if you've never talked about that before. Now, if you know that they're the president of some, Fortune 500 company, then I think you could probably make some assumptions and you might be safer offering to have them invest with you. But if you're just in an average neighborhood and you've got a neighbor who, lives an average life, how would you know that unless you ask? So anyway, that's kind of where that comes in, is that pre-existing substantive relationship is derived to be able to be your defense if anyone ever questions you and says, well, you generally solicited this offer, and you can say, no, I had relationships with all these people. So not only do you have to have had the conversation, but you have to have a record-keeping system that shows how you when you had these conversations, what information you gathered from these conversations, and that conversation predated any offer you might have made to that investor.
And I just want to jump into a little bit about, keeping record or that system about that conversation about suitability. So in your book, you had talked a little bit about the pre-qualification forms to complete. What does that form look like? Do you complete that after the conversation with the investor saying, I determined their suitability, and then just keep it for your records, just so that in case that suitability was ever questioned.
So I think that the pre-qualification form is just part of your record keeping system. So it may be the first thing that you have as a record of an investor. You know, perhaps you meet somebody and they say, yeah, I might be interested in investing with you. You send them the pre-qualification form. They fill out whether they're accredited or sophisticated on that form. They send it back to you. But you still need to have that further conversation, as the SEC illustrated in that VC citizen no action letter. It's like they want more than just a form. They want you to actually have had a conversation and talk to these people about their investing goals, what they've invested in before. And not only that, you really need to get to know somebody. You know, just because somebody has money doesn't mean you want them in your deal. I mean, I think we probably all know people, if we looked around our own circle of acquaintances and said, I would never want that guy to invest with me, because they would drive you crazy, or for some other reason that you just don't want to be associated with them. So you've got to think about the fact that you're getting to know this person. It's an interview, right? You're interviewing them to find out if you want them in your deal, as much as you're giving them an opportunity to get to know you a little bit as well. So the relationship goes two ways, but also think of it as a way to kind of emotionally pre-qualify somebody, as well as just financially pre-qualify them.
Got it. So that's 506B, where there's no advertising allowed.
That's right.
I want to spend a little bit of time on 506C, the Jobs Act, and also Regulation A plus, in terms of how that's different than 506B. And if somebody is, you're going to be using 506C, where the advertising is allowed, what are some of the requirements for someone who will be looking to do a syndication?
So for 506C, so back to our definitions, that allows you to raise an unlimited amount of money from an unlimited number of verified accredited investors. So the distinction here is that with 506B, the investors were allowed to self-certify. So they just had to check some boxes, which they will do not on a pre-qualification form, but when you give them a subscription agreement. So I think we should talk at some point about what's in a securities offering, but that's one of the documents. And they're going to go through a questionnaire during that subscription agreement and tell you a little bit more about their suitability requirements, and just get that documented for you even yet again, so that you have further substantiation that you understood their financial situation before you allowed them to invest. So that's for 506B. They self-certify. They tell you that in their own words. You don't have to do a background check or verify any of their information, as long as you don't have a reason to believe it's incorrect. With 506C, the investors actually have to provide you some proof that they're accredited. So they either have to have gone to their own CPA, a registered investment advisor, attorney, somebody with a license who will vouch for them, and who will send you a letter saying, I've reviewed their financials within the last 90 days and I've found them to be accredited. And then they put their license on the line. Your requirement is to have a reasonable assurance that all the people that invested with you are accredited at the time they invest, and that it was verified within the last 90 days prior to making the investment. So somebody can't go out and just get a letter from a CPA, once a year and just give it to whoever they want to invest with. That's not going to work. It has to be updated within the 90 days prior. So you're required to have this verification. So you want them to go out and get that letter. And if they don't have their own person that can do it, there are companies that will do it for them, and that will produce a letter from an attorney or a CPA that will give you that verification.
Got it. But in the hedge fund world, what I'm noticing is a lot more companies or funds are using the 506B instead of 506C, even though the advertising is allowed with 506C. And I wonder, what am I missing? Why are not more people take advantage of 506C?
Well, because the estimates are that only about 10% of the population is accredited. So I think these large hedge funds are correctly recognizing that there are a huge amount of people that don't happen to have $1 million net worth, or, but that meet the and don't meet the income requirements, but they have a substantial amount of savings and they're fine investors. So the hedge funds are saying, you know, we're not going to cut ourselves out of 90% of the population in order to raise our $1 billion fund.
Got it. And the other question I have is in terms of, you know, what can go wrong? So what are the risks of accepting private money, and how can you, or what have you seen in your practice in terms of improper solicitation or some of the investors getting themselves in trouble with the securities violation?
I think probably the biggest, most rampant thing that I see on a regular basis are people trying to pay finders to find money for them. So these, it's when you're dealing in the securities world, these exemptions that we've been talking about, Regulation D, Rule 506, is just one of them. Now, there are other exemptions. There's Rule 504. There's some state level exemptions. And there's a few other things. But these exemptions apply to the issuer of the securities. So these are issuer exemptions. The issuer is usually going to be the investor level entity that we talked about. So that investor level entity, whatever its name is, you know, ABC Investments, LLC. Well, ABC Investments, LLC is named with the SEC as the issuer of those securities. We file a form with the SEC called a Form D that tells the SEC, this is the name of the company. These are the live human beings that are associated with this company. And here's their personal addresses. And this is the exemption that they're claiming. This is how much they're going to raise. This is what it's for, et cetera, et cetera. We have to file this form with the SEC for you to claim these exemptions. It's not absolutely required that we file the form, but it does give you a safe harbor, kind of a presumption that you complied with the laws if we file the form. So it's the correct thing to do is always file the form. So this is where, you know, we will kind of establish who the issuer is. Anybody connected with that issuer is entitled to this Rule 506 exemption if that's the one we've picked. But people outside of that company are not entitled to claim that exemption. So if you have a third party go raise money for you, the only people that can do that and actually earn compensation for doing that have to be licensed securities broker dealers. And if you use somebody, you know, pay a commission or something that looks like a commission to somebody who's not a licensed broker dealer, then the issuer could lose their exemption. And that third party could be charged with selling securities without a license, which can be a pretty harsh penalty. And that third party could also remain liable for all of those investments that they referred to that deal for the life of those investments. So that's not something that these outside third parties should want to take on, but it's very rampant in the industry for an issuer, usually at the management level. They'll say, oh, well, you know, so-and-so knows somebody with $100,000, so I'll bring them in and make them a member of my management team. And you know, when you do that 15 times, it's not really plausible. The rule is that all of the people in the management team can be compensated for the roles they play in management other than raising money, and that nobody should be compensated for the amount of money that they've raised unless they have a license, even if they're within the management team. So anything, any kind of commission, anything based on, they call it transaction-based compensation. Any transaction-based compensation is taboo unless you're paying it to somebody who has a securities license.
Got it. So how does then most companies raise money? Do they usually have a pre-existing relationship with other investors before they file Form D? So how do they go about, or what have you seen in terms of investors raising capital?
Well, so the right progression is that as you're thinking about developing a syndication business, then you should be doing two things. One, you should be learning how to buy the assets that you want to acquire. And you should be doing that through, you know, if it's real estate, you should be doing it through a real estate coach or, you know, some kind of a business coach if it's a different type of business. And then you should also be learning and understanding securities laws. and then going out and developing relationships with these investors. So it's really two departments or two divisions within your syndication business. One is chasing deals, one is developing relationships with investors. And if you get those two machines working concurrently, then the idea is that when you do get something under contract, you will have enough investors in your database to be able to fund that deal, and you will have enough knowledge from your training to be able to make the deal viable and do the improvements and to make it a profitable venture.
Got it. So instead of going ahead and forming LLCs and setting up these structures, you should try to do those two things that you mentioned in terms of learning how to build those assets and then building those relationships with investors.
Yeah, the goal is for you to have a healthy database of investors so that by the time you get your first deal under contract, you feel confident that you can go ahead and raise the money from the group that you've already pre-qualified. So the SEC, a couple of years ago, published some statistics and they said the average Regulation D, the median Regulation D Rule 506 offering raises $1.5 million with 14 investors. So, you're looking at around $100,000 per investor. You can have twice as many of that. We usually, when we write offerings, we'll write them with $50,000 minimums. So you could easily have twice as many investors as that. But the other rule of thumb, kind of from the real estate side, is you probably need to have about 2 to 3 times as many investors as you're in your database as you need to fund your deal. And that's because a lot of people are, they'll be invested elsewhere. Their money's tied up here or there. They can't get to it. They're just not interested. You need to be able to approach 3 to 4 times as many people as you think you need to fund that deal in order to get it funded.
Got it. So let's just shift a little bit from real estate, but let's say if somebody is interested in the equities markets and they still want to use 506B with non-accredited investors, and let's say their minimum is like you mentioned, either 50,000 or 100,000, could they still use the 506B to start perhaps a hedge fund?
Sure, they absolutely. These securities exemptions we're talking about do not depend at all on what it is that you're raising money for. So the rules apply regardless of what you're raising money for. So you could be buying airplanes, you could be buying yachts. If you're putting a group together to form that, common group and common goal in doing that syndication, then you could be buying anything. It doesn't matter if it's small companies or real estate.
And I know you had mentioned that earlier, but how many is the non-accredited maximum number of non-accredited investors in the 506B?
Up to 35.
Up to 35. Okay, got it. And I know earlier in the conversation you had mentioned about subscription agreements. So I was wondering if you can walk me through some of these offering documents like private placement memorandum, operating agreement. I think most investors are familiar with that if they own the LLC, and also the subscription agreement. If you can walk us through those three, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked earlier about the fact that we're kind of two parts of your securities offering. I like to just envision this like a sandwich, right? You've got the two layers of bread and you got the meat in the middle. Well, the meat in the middle is your investment contract, whatever that is. It could be a promissory note. It could be buying interest in your company that you'll do through an operating agreement. It could be some kind of a convertible note or a warrant or, there's all manner of documents that you can use to create an investment contract. So that's kind of the meat of the sandwich. You got to figure out first, what's your business model? What are you selling? And what are you going to give people in exchange for their money? What piece of paper are you giving them? And that operating agreement is going to spell out, the rights and duties of all of the participants. In a context of our syndication where you have an LLC, a manager managed LLC, it's going to show the rights and duties of the managers. It's going to show whether you have different classes of members. Usually we're going to use two classes of members. Class A is going to be your cash paying investors. Class B is going to be your members who are providing services. That's usually going to be members of your management team. It's also going to describe what kind of fees the manager is entitled to earn and when, and how profits are going to be distributed amongst the member classes. And then also what has to happen before people get their money back. And, you know, when is there a point in time that that's going to happen? Is it going to happen over time? All those things are going to be described in something called a waterfall that is in the distribution section of the operating agreement. So you're always looking for that waterfall. And the waterfall, they call it a waterfall just because you say, okay, we have this much cash that we can distribute. We're going to do it in this order. First, we're going to give some here, then we're going to give some there, then there, until that those funds are exhausted. So that's all going to be described in that operating agreement. In the private placement memorandum, there's going to be some overlap in what the private placement memorandum content versus what's in the operating agreement. But the PPM is the SEC's required disclosure. You're doing a 506B offering that includes non-accredited investors. You are required to have a private placement memorandum. And if you are doing a 506B offering that doesn't have non-accredited investors in it, you're not required to have a PPM, but we think it's a very good idea and kind of crazy for you not to have it if you have more than 3 to 4 accredited investors who you know very, very well. The reason for that is that this PPM is going to disclose all of the risks to your investors of what it is they're investing in and all the different things that could go wrong that could cause them to lose all or part of their money. And after they read that document, and if they still decide to invest with you anyway, then they have assumed the risk of the investment. So if one of those things happens, they can't blame you for it. Without that document, you don't have that protection because they could easily come back and say, oh gosh, if I'd known that would have happened, then I never would have invested in this deal. Then you're required when you're selling securities to give the investors all the material facts they need to make informed consent. That's the purpose of the PPM, is to give them all those material facts. The subscription agreement is kind of the other side of that. So the PPM is where you tell the investors about all the risks of investing. The subscription agreement is where the investor tells you about them, about themselves. So they describe to you their qualifications to be in your deal. There's a whole section in there called investor representations and warranties. So you're going to, you know, they're going to attest and assert under penalty of perjury that, yes, I am an accredited investor. Yes, I have read all the PPM. I do understand all the risks. I do meet the qualifications to be in this deal. I understand I could lose all or part of my money, and I'm going to invest anyway. So that's what the subscription agreement's about. And then so we've got the PPM. We've got the operating agreement for the investor level LLC. We've got the subscription agreement. We'll also need to do some securities notice filings. So we'll file that Form D with the SEC, telling them which exemption you're claiming and giving them the identification information for the relevant associated people. And then we would also file notices with the states. These are called blue sky notices. I don't know why they're called that, but it's been around for a long time. So these state securities notices are required when you sell investments to somebody within a specific state, and you have usually 15 days from when you made that sale to filing this notice. So that's kind of what makes up your securities offering. The other document that we didn't discuss that you're going to need is something for your management team. So that's going to be that operating agreement at the management level for the people within management, talking about how you're going to split up the fees that the manager earns and how you're going to make decisions related to that investor level entity.
So just to follow up on the subscription agreement, so let's assume that you're using 506B and you have, you know, under 35 non-accredited investors. Is that subscription agreement still required for non-accredited investors? And if it is required, what does that say then, if they, since they are not accredited?
Well, the subscription agreement is always required. Okay, the thing that might be optional is the private placement memorandum. So you're always going to want them to use the subscription agreement because that's where they certify to you that they've assumed those risks. Without that, you don't have any way of documenting that you gave them the proper documentation, they understand all the risks, and they went ahead and invested anyway. So you always want the subscription agreement, and that subscription agreement, it doesn't matter if you're accredited or non-accredited, everybody's going to fill that out. They're just going to specify in that agreement which of those qualifications they meet.
Got it. And just want to jump into a little bit in terms of cost. You mentioned, state filings, Form D. What do you think the total cost would be for all this before somebody launches a fund, sort of that pre-launch cost?
Well, there depends. I mean, we have products that range from, $1,000 to $25,000. And so it really depends what you're trying to accomplish. And some we write a lot of joint ventures that are, between a few members. All of them are going to be considered managing members, so it's a member managed LLC. It's very simplistic to be used as the manager of a syndicate. Those are going to be, $2,000 to $3,000, $2,500 plus costs, kind of thing. Husband and wife LLCs are going to be much less than that. The entire offering package—that's the PPM, the operating agreement, subscription agreement, securities notice filings—very typical fees for that. You should be budgeting $10,000 to $15,000 for that. Depending on what how much you're raising, what your investment contract is going to be, and including the filings and all of that. If you're going to be doing a big fund, or you're going to be raising $50 or $100 million, you're going to be looking at more like $25,000 to $30,000. Those documents are going to be more complicated, and there's going to be a lot more time that goes into generating them and making sure that they have all the right provisions that are going to work for all of your investors.
Got it. And your firm, is it does it mostly do real estate syndication, or do you guys do some other private placement funds like hedge funds as well, or do you just concentrate on real estate syndication?
Most of our clients are real estate clients, but we have helped other clients that have been in other spaces, and we're happy to do so. Like I said, the offering documents are largely the same. It's just a matter of what do you want to use for that investment contract, and really just deciding what that's going to be and how it's going to look is kind of the first step in making that decision. But yes, we can help people with any kind of securities offering.
Got it. I mean, your book is fantastic. I greatly recommend it. I really want to thank you for joining us today. But so if somebody wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way for people to reach out to you, find more about you, get your book? Can you tell us?
Yeah, so the phone number to reach us is 844-796-3428. And that actually is 844 Syndicate, SYNDIC, and the number 8. That's a good phone number for us. But a better way to reach us is at our website at syndicationattorneys.com, syndicationattorneys.com. And while you're there, I would encourage you to sign up for our newsletter. We do free monthly teleseminars once a month where I'll either teach a subject or we'll bring in a guest speaker. I would also encourage you to visit our library. In our library, we have a very extensive library of over 40 articles and all of our previously recorded teleseminars. We've been doing this for more than 3 years now. We have a lot of FAQs, so these are things people frequently ask us, and we're constantly posting new information on the website, so you can keep abreast of that on the website as well and get notified each time we post a new article. But that's the best way. And you can also schedule an appointment with me there.
Got it. And your book is on Amazon as well.
It is. The book is on Amazon. It's an Amazon number one bestseller. We're super excited about that. And we'd love to have you to read the book.
Great. Thank you, Kim. I really appreciate you joining us today.